Arts and entertainment company Meow Wolf creates large-scale, interactive, and immersive art installations. They recently opened their fifth installation in Houston. Austin-based hardware and software developer Alan Watts created many of their custom interactive devices, database-driven platforms, and animation software. Alan joins us this time on the Plutopia podcast.
You see maybe 10% of the work on the outside at a Meow Wolf. And, you know, you go behind the scenes and look at the server rooms and, you know, the documents and the schematics and the one-line diagrams. And it's like, oh my God, there is this, like, before anything even begins production, we've done interactivity matrices. We've, you know, built out, you know, diagrams. And it's kind of amazing to see how much work goes into these. And then just sustaining them, too, is incredibly expensive because it's like, yeah, this is stuff that's going to break. And it's tech. And it's very expensive to maintain, and you know, to have the, you know, the staff to do that requires, you know, they have to, you know, we hand things off when we're done, so we have to hire people and train them, you know, that have a certain, you know, technical knowledge to be able to fix things on their own. And we're a company of 1,000 people now, you know, across all of our locations, so it's a beast now. It's truly a beast.
Welcome to the Plutopia News Network. Here we are with yet another episode of our podcast. We're probably nearing 350 episodes. We've been rolling along for a while. Today, our guest is Alan Watts. He's joining Scoop Sweeney and I, John Lepkoski. Alan is a software and hardware developer, and he's also a senior exhibitions creative engineer at Meow Wolf, which is an organization that creates large-scale, interactive, and immersive art installations that are just fantastic. I love Meow Wolf. How about you, Scoop? Have you been there?
No, I haven't been traveling a lot in recent years, so that's on my to-do list because I'd like to go to Santa.
Right on.
But I don't get up there very often.
Well, there's one.
In Houston
there
now.
There you go. Yeah, I was about to say, got one closer to Austin now.
That is good. What part of Houston? I used to work in radio in Houston at Pacifica Radio, KPFT, and.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
That was an interesting place to live back then. It was quite conservative.
Right. Yeah. The location's in the Fourth Ward, so just northeast of downtown. Right next to St. Arnold's Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an old sheet metal factory building. Really great space that we kind of reclaimed.
Yeah, the hip district back then was the Montrose district, which is right. Very upscale. I looked at some of my old houses, and they're now condos. You know, vintage housing got bulldozed and replaced with a lot of big buildings.
Yeah, kind of like the South Austin of Houston.
Very much.
Yeah.
So, Alan, do you have people who ask you about all those books you wrote about Buddhism years ago?
I was about to ask, like, you know, I'm not that Alan Watts, right? Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is always great to, you know, when I meet people and they learn my full name and, you know, they ask about if I know Alan Watts. So that's always a good indicator that people are, you know, well versed and educated. we have similar kind of beliefs, because I'm a big fan of Alan Watts, and he was definitely pretty formative when I learned about him in high school and was like, hey, who's this Alan Watts guy? So yeah, he's one of my favorite authors still, somebody that I can always go back to and feel right at home picking up a book, you know, from the 60s or 50s. And yeah, so he's just like so timeless still.
Well, he set me on a path too. Some of the stuff he wrote was pretty amazing. And there's, you know, there's recordings, there's audio of Alan Watts. I recall listening to one of those one time after a guy and I had been having a big discussion about, he was coming from a more sort of materialist position and I was coming from a more sort of Buddhist position. And then a recording of Alan Watts came on the radio. And it was a complete reflection of the conversation we just had. It was like the same discussion, you know. And I took that a sign, I guess.
Well,
yeah.
But
when I was working in the Bay Area, a couple of different radio stations there were on the weekends, you know, airing old recordings of Alan, and it was just amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Wish I could get hold of that now.
Yeah, his work as play, you know, kind of motif that he talks a lot about really resonates with me and kind of my work now, and just kind of my approach, you know. And I feel like that's, yeah, definitely a direct line to happiness and satisfaction, is to, you know, find what makes you happy. And if you can make a job out of it, even better.
Well, and that's a good segue into actually the first question I had for you is kind of what specifically you do at Meow Wolf as Senior Exhibitions Creative Engineer and how that relates to all the other work you've done.
Yeah, so that's a pretty wordy title, but it basically means I get to make fun, interactive devices for Meow Wolf. So my background, I come from a like software and animation and video kind of background. And I started to get into Arduinos and really was missing. I went to art school and, you know, was kind of a craftsperson, really like making stuff with my hands. And I started to get deep into software and web background, backends, and, you know, kind of was missing the creative outlet that my artistic, you know, kind of endeavors took me to. And discovered the Arduino platform, you know, maybe must have been 10 years ago, and kind of saw this as a great opportunity to kind of bring together, you know, the software side and the hardware side into, you know, kind of the this kind of perfect kind of interactive and playful, you know, kind of machines. And so got into making some kind of, you know, little game, interactive games kind of on the side as a hobby, and would show them at actually South by Southwest shows and different events around Austin. And eventually Meow Wolf picked up on Austin as their as a potential location when they were, after they opened Santa Fe and were growing, you know, kind of like gangbusters, and were looking for their next spot to grow to. And Austin kind of became a big spot on their radar because of the community here via DIY art scene and, you know, very like tech minded community with South by Southwest here and just all the other game meetups and that sort of thing. And so met them, and it was just kind of a match made in heaven when we found each other. And, you know, we're doing very similar kind of interactives and immersive environments. And it kind of was like, oh my God, you know, it's like, we gotta, you know, find a way to work together. And the Austin project fell through after, you know, getting pretty close to actually happening. But Denver and Vegas.
Yeah, which was disappointing.
It was, yeah, it was a total bummer. But, you know, they came back to me about a year after the Austin project fell through and asked if I would move to Santa Fe, because my name had been coming up in some of the projects that they were doing, and kind of starting to think about more games and kind of how to build interactives that are playful and engaging to people that, you know, weren't complicated. And so it really fit my aesthetic and what I was doing with my, you know, kind of my creations on the side. And so basically I couldn't refuse that offer. You know, it was a great opportunity to one, to go to Santa Fe in New Mexico, which I, you know, have really a soft spot for. I'm a big backpacker and nature lover. So being immersed in the mountains is like pretty sweet spot to be in for that. And so basically I was just given a lot of like free reign to build interactives. You know, the way that Meow Wolf kind of exhibitions come about is that, you know, there's kind of a general like narrative umbrella that the exhibitions, you know, kind of follow. You know, in Santa Fe, it's a house that this family has disappeared. But then there's all these kind
House of Eternal Return.
Right. Yeah. And then Omega Mart in Las Vegas, which is a grocery store. Denver is a big like transit station, like intergalactic transit station. So they all these kind of themes that, you know, kind of like the story follows, but there's a lot of just kind of free-for-alls, you know, where artists can come in and propose a project or an entire space or an interactive, and, you know, kind of given a lot of kind of creative freedom to implement it. And, you know, we've got a full production facility in Santa Fe where we fabricate a lot of our pieces and then ship them to site for install. So it's just amazing to have this kind of level up in terms of, you know, the resources at my fingertips that I can like build and kind of design something that I couldn't do otherwise, you know, in my shop here in Austin. You know, I've got a wood shop and can do pretty basic, you know, fabrication, but, you know, to have an army of fabricators and sculptors and painters, and, you know, fabric specialists. And, it's a really fascinating place to work, where we can collaborate and, you know, kind of have our own ideas and, become a creative lead on a project, and then have, people to support that vision. And then also as a creative engineer, you know, I kind of work in, both as a creative lead. So I'll usually have, one or two projects in an exhibition that's, you know, kind of my idea. I'll pitch, you know, basically they have like an internal RFP where it's like, hey, you know, it's like, we've got this space, we need, you know, some kind of interactive. So put together a proposal and goes to the creative directors and, you know, the project team. And then ideas get kind of refined and then get kicked back to us. It's kind of like, okay, you know, it's like, you know, here's your timeline, here's your budget, and, you know, have at it kind of thing. So I'll usually have a couple of projects that I'm the lead on, where it's kind of my my design, and I'll kind of lead the production and, you know, kind of seed all the way through, do all the programming, and then go to site for install. And then another handful of projects will be another artist's projects, you know, since not everybody's a, you know, technical at Meow Wolf. And a lot of projects do have, you know, LEDs and lights and interactives. So sometimes an artist will come to us, as there's seven creative engineers at Meow Wolf right now. And so we've got kind of a pretty diverse skill set, where we've got some, you know, like Max MSP for audio generation. We've got like video people that are touch designer specialists. We've got, you know, lighting designers. I'm kind of more focused on like game design, and then also do a lot of like custom PCBs and electronics to support other projects. So yeah, there'll be cases where an artist comes to, you know, one of the creative engineers like, hey, you know, I want my sculpture to light up when you push a button. And so we work with the artist to kind of, you know, design how that interactive works, and then work with the production team to kind of like, you know, we have to think about all these things that I never thought about before, but in terms of like maintenance and tech access and, you know, code, you know, there's all sorts of things you have to start considering now, you know, with the, unfortunately, the guests are get pretty violent at times and break things. So a lot of times, you know, we have to consider how easy things are to fix and replace, and, you know, things can't be too custom, because they have to be, you know, we've got a tech ops team that we hand the projects over to when we open, and they're the ones that basically have to fix everything. So it's documentation, it's writing, you know, one line diagrams and tech systems diagrams. So, you know, what you see at a Meow Wolf is probably like 10% of what is actually happening in the background in terms of like the tech infrastructure and the networking and the lighting systems. It's a pretty fascinating, you know, behind the curtains scene, that I wish we could like showcase a little more, because to me, that's more interesting. And for a lot of people, it is too, to kind of see behind the curtain of what makes this really tick.
Yeah. I was looking online at a lot of your projects, for all of Meow Wolf seems to be creativity on steroids.
Right. Yeah. I mean, their yeah. whole, you know, kind of approach is maximalism. You know, that's what it's all about, you know, just kind of like, let's just blow people's minds. Like, you know, it's kind of like all ages. You can kind of dig into the story if you want to, but you can also just walk around and be fascinated by, yeah, all the lights and sounds and the artwork and sculptures and all that. So it's a really great, you know, kind of like covers all the bases of creativity.
Yeah, you were talking about mind-blowing creativity. I noticed that Denver's having a psychedelic bicycle day.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
And that sounds like something that would be kind of a balancing act between legal and not so. You know, Colorado is, you know, somewhat progressive, but only in certain parts. So,
right, yeah.
How did that? Any, you have any idea how that came about and how it's being handled?
Is that a Meow Wolf, like an actual event that's happening at Meow Wolf? I mean, I'm not surprised. It does make sense because it's like, it's a very, you know, it leans into psychedelia pretty blatantly. Doesn't really like, you know, try to sugarcoat it. You know, it's just, it is what it is. And I think that when you read a lot of descriptions about people, you know, online reviews, a lot of them do refer to, like, you know, mushrooms and acid and psychedelic. And, you know, so I think it's pretty common knowledge that it's a pretty close like overlap.
Yeah. The article I saw was in the Denver Post, and it talks about the bicycle day party starting at Meow Wolf and running to Coors Field. So sound like an interesting, it would be interesting balancing act there.
Right. Yeah. And
I can imagine somebody saying, let's do some mushrooms and go to Meow Wolf. And then the answer is, you don't need mushrooms if you're going to Meow Wolf. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, our staff is trained to deal with people that are, you know, having bad trips. You know, it's like that is a known, you know, thing that happens. And so I really appreciate that. You know, that we've got people, you know, trained in how to respond to, you know, events like that, because it's not illegal, or it's illegal, but it's still, like, you know, kind of openly done, and kind of like
some places it's illegal.
Yeah, right.
It may be legal elsewhere, I don't know.
So I think it's, we don't really shy away from you know, the fact that we opened up two locations in Texas, and, you know, Meow Wolf is pretty openly, you know, supportive of gay rights and trans rights. And, you know, I think I really appreciate that we're willing to step into places and show up and support the community, you know, because, like, the location in Dallas is in Grapevine, which is super conservative. It's in a mall, you know, in the suburbs. And so I'm really grateful that we're going into places that would otherwise not be exposed to this kind of, you know, these worlds, and maybe it'll help expand people's minds a little bit. You know, don't need to have mushrooms. It's like, maybe if somebody can have the same experience and that kind of joy and connection, then I think that's great. You know, I think we're doing a good thing.
It may be political without really being political, right?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, art is political despite
the
core intention of the art.
Yep. Yeah.
And I'm actually pretty happy that those installations are here in Texas, not just because they're close, but I think Texas needs it.
Right. Yeah.
A dose of creativity, a big dose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's good for people to, you know, I hope people that would otherwise not, you know, kind of like embrace these ideas can see it for what it is. And like, okay, this is creativity. This is like being human. People all want the same thing. They want to have fun. They want joy. And this is a way that it's just kind of like, there's not this political overtone about it. You know, it's like, there shouldn't be, you know, there doesn't need to be that. You know, and it is funny to see reviews that are, you know, negative about Meow Wolf, that they're, you know, saying it's Satanist and, you know, there's like devil worshiping happening and, you know, there's like polluting children's minds. And it's like, okay, it's like, I mean, I'm glad that people have that reaction to it, because it's, you know, the fact that people are thinking outside of their comfort zone, I think is fine too. You know, they might not like it. That's fine. And it's like, everybody can't like everything.
Yeah, given the current political environment, I was impressed by the courage I think it took for Meow Wolf to have pride events, because that's become a real target under the current administration.
Right.
Have you experienced at some of these events, problems, picketers, people that object to it?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, Meow Wolf, I feel like, is a little bit of a, wouldn't say untouchable, but, you know, I feel like it's kind of a space that people don't really get, you know, like fervently against, you know, because it's like, at a certain degree, it's like, okay, this is a good thing that's happening. And, you know, I think if it was to get, you know, some kind of protest about an event, I think it would backfire on that organization that decided to, you know, to host it, or, you know, kind of like be that person that kind of ruins this good thing for everybody. So I have not heard of anything. You know, I'm sure there have been like very small occurrences of things like that, especially in a place like Grapevine. But, you know, I'm also kind of like, it's kind of amazing that it's gone relatively smooth for Meow Wolf. Because I think it's, yeah, we're not overt about it. You know, it's just like, it is what it is. We're kind of like very all inclusive, you know? So I feel like it's just kind of like, you can't really complain about that.
I think it would have been kind of like what Hakim Bey used to refer to as a TAZ, a temporary autonomous zone. And as a temporary autonomous zone, it should be kind of a safe place to just open up, right?
And it should
be safe from politics, really.
And I think people see that, and, you know, the people that don't want to engage with it just don't engage with it, you know, as it should be. And it's like, you don't have to like everything, but you don't have to be against it to the point that you're going to ruin it for everybody else. You know, it's like, that's fine to have opinions on things, but just let people be.
You mentioned how each installation has sort of a theme. Who decides on the theme? How does that evolve?
Yeah, so we've got an actual story team on staff, and it's a handful of people, and they're kind of like the lore keepers. So there's, you know, there is a kind of like overarching universe that exists in Meow Wolf, and, you know, so all the exhibitions are connected, you know, whether it's by a character or by an event or, you know, some kind of like intergalactic tunnel, you know, there is kind of a connection, but they're also very, very loose and open-ended in a kind of on purpose to kind of leave things up to the, you know, to the guest to kind of interpret and kind of make their own storyline around. So we do have a narrative team that develops that exhibition's narrative, you know, and starts to write characters and the storyline, and then they develop all the materials. You know, when you're in a Meow Wolf, there's all these, you know, like computers with the narrative content, there's books, there's, you know, printouts, there's newspapers, there's all these kind of like nuggets of the story that you can explore, which, you know, for the people that get into the lore and the narrative, you know, they can spend hours at Meow Wolf and, you know, just like digging into all the, it's kind of amazing, you know, when you go to Meow Wolf and once you realize, like in Houston, it's a radio station, like a community radio station. And once you realize that every piece of content in that radio station and in that exhibition is all custom made, you know, there's band posters, there's, you know, the computers you get on, you can look at emails, you can listen to files, you can listen to voicemails, you can get on the phone and call other extensions. All that content is created by our, you know, our team. And it's amazing because you look at a poster and it's got a phone number on it, and that's the only place that phone number is. But if you go to a certain phone and call that number, you get a message that's connected to that poster that phone number was on. And then it kind of like, you know, kind of carts you away to the next kind of story point. But it's fascinating to me. You know, I kind of execute things with pretty minimal narrative connectivity. You know, I'll, like in Houston, I've got a piece that has a narrative connection, but it wasn't until kind of after the fact that we made it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I'm making this computer, and it was like, hey, you know, Alan, would you want to make some kind of like you know, fun little nugget to the story that we can come up with? And so we kind of developed this, you know, kind of like mini narrative storyline that kind of fit the the overall narrative, but it was just kind of in mostly in service of my interactive and just kind of like a way to tie it in kind of and add that little bit of an Easter egg. So if people that people do want to, you know, just kind of play with the interactive and just kind of like play the game, they can. But then if they want to like, hey, wait, it was like, what's this number here? Like, I got this code from this thing. What if I enter it on here? And it kind of unlocks, you know, this kind of next level kind of storytelling approach that, you know, I think people kind of expect from Meow Wolf at this point. And it's really fun to kind of find those places that we can, you know, drop in those little nuggets for people. And, you know, the ones that find it are get excited about it. The ones that don't have no idea, but are still having a good time.
So Houston's Meow Wolf is a radio station, you say?
Yeah, you might really like it. Yeah,
coming from well, the background. You know, being my, time in Houston in the early 70s at KPFT, when we were bombed off the air twice by the Ku Klux Klan, they dynamited our transmitter twice.
Oh, damn.
So radio, progressive radio was not well received back in those days.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The station is still around. It's gone through many changes, many uproars, and it's been up and down many times, but it's hung in there. So, you know, they might be some interesting folk for you to contact and get involved if you're looking for that kind of thing. Because
yeah, totally. Yeah, it sounds like
quite a history of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the radio station is, you know, a little different. They didn't get bombed, but they opened up a galactic portal to over audio airwaves. So it's kind of a great little, kind of warp on a community radio station and kind of like how they've unlocked, you know, it plays a lot into sound and the kind of like importance of sound that we don't even really consider a lot of times. So it's a really great, like very audio focused. In the creative tech department that I'm a part of at Meow Wolf, we have an audio team, and they were the ones that drove a lot of the interactives in Houston because it was so audio focused. The whole kind of story is delivered through that lens of audio and sound and a radio station and wavelengths and aliens. And it's a great little, it's a great story.
It sounds like a wonderful idea. I have to go now.
Right? Yeah. And it's funny because when we were building, you know, we get a lot of contractors to actually build out the interior spaces. And, you know, a lot of them don't really know what Meow Wolf is. And so it's super confusing to them, I'm sure, because, you know, we're building this kind of like, you know, fantastical space with all these like, you know, kind of like weird rock work and, you know, tunnels and secret passages. And then inside of it is this 1970s looking radio station, you know, with an on-air, you know, audio booth and, you know, isolation booths. And the contractors were so confused, you know, because it's like, wait, and it's like, what is this? You know, it's just like, we're building this kind of like weird place, but then there's this regular like green room inside of this, you know.
It sounds great. Yeah, I've been doing radio for a long time. In fact, let me switch to the other camera. I'm surrounded by all the stuff I've done in radio. Just that's all the a few of the albums I've got, to you know, hundreds of albums. I've got reel to reel.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I mean, I like analog, but I also am very digital. And I run a couple of online radio stations on Live 365, which is one of the original.
Oh, right. Yeah. You know, I remember that.
Do it yourself radio.
Yeah.
So it's just great that you're doing that, because radio has been kind of threatened. They actually, the government wanted to do away, well, not the government so much, but auto manufacturers wanted to take AM radio off of radios in their cars.
Oh, I saw that recently.
And that's a dangerous idea, because a lot of times AM radio is all you can get in certain, you know, especially rural areas. And when it comes to things like emergency alerts, you know, mm-hmm. tornado warnings, those are the people that will be giving those out.
Yeah. I used to love listening. I used to do a lot of road trips out to Arizona and New Mexico. And the only thing at 2 a.m. was Art Bell, finding on AMs.
Art Bell,
Like,
coast to coast.
I used to, that used to freak me out when I would be driving alone on, some desert road, late at night. And Art Bell was like, well, it was like, this is all I got. So here we
That
go.
was great radio.
Oh man, it was the best.
You know, removing AM radio would be like removing one of the dimensions from a trans-dimensional space. It
Exactly.
just kind of doesn't make
I think they would
sense. It
all the
might
other
alter reality.
right? All the wavelengths would fall apart. AM is kind of like the, the bookends of reality. So it's just
Yeah, John and I grew up in the same town in West Texas, and I got my radio start at the local radio station.
well,
One of my first gigs.
We had lots of good radio there. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
I did a jazz radio show in the late night in the middle of West Texas. And
Wow.
most people heard that. How did anyone listen? Well, we had an Air Force base here, so there were a lot of foreigners living there. Foreigners being people not from Texas who actually understood jazz.
But I think, yeah, thinking
Wolfman
about
Scoop.
that, and I think just, having access to that kind of, which I think is what Meow Wolf does, the kind of just like broadcast this kind of weird stuff. It's not a matter of like who's listening or what you're not trying to quantify it by any kind of like, oh, this many people are listening, so that's a good thing. But just kind of like having that as a something that somebody can discover, I think is a, such a major part, like I think growing up for me too, just like finding music on the radio and, not having it fed to me or kind of like expectations of what I need to listen to, but that ability to kind of explore on my own and find out what interested me and not having this kind of like, predetermined, packaged culture, I think is so important. And yeah, when we lose that kind of free form ability to learn, then it's just like that's kind of scary, at least for me.
It was always kind of interesting. The more distant radio stations came in better at night for whatever reason. So at night, when you were kind of laying on your bed, that's when you'd get like Coma from Oklahoma and Wolfman Jack from just across the border.
Oh, the border.
And so it really did have that. I mean, I mentioned transdimensional. It was kind of a transdimensional reality right there.
Oh, right. Yeah, picking up all the
I
civil.
have a question about your structure. I mean, is Meow Wolf structured as a co-op?
No, I wish
Or
we were. Yeah, that was, we are now a full-on corporate entity with all the good and the bad that comes with that. So yeah, we're definitely, very corporate hierarchy. We've got a CEO, we've got all the C-suite people, we've got we got middle managers, we got management. So yeah, we're run as a production company now. And, it's like we did start out as a collective, or, it was before my time that, Meow Wolf was the art collective that you hear about. And that they kind of loosely tried to, claim for, a few years after. But, I think just the reality of needing, raising money and building these very large scale, productions can't be done with a kind of an art collective approach.
you could do it as a co-op, but it's going to be harder. It's governance is harder for a co-op. I mean, I was just wondering about that because as you described the way that the installations are sort of created, envisioned and created, it sounds like a cooperative effort.
I think in terms of like our creative process, it's a very co-op, kind of like approach of just kind of like, yeah, nobody there's, I have a ton of autonomy. I can come up with ideas. I can, go to people directly to help, fabricate things. But in terms of like, the structure around, finances and, pay and benefits and all that, it's, I feel like we've kind of lost that battle. I think there's a lot of hopes that we would kind of be able to, I think we transformed the kind of experience economy early on. And I think there was hopes that we would also transform the corporate governance of how you could structure these companies. But I think it got away from Meow Wolf too early.
It's hard. Around the time that Meow Wolf appeared, Plutopia also appeared, and we were actually originally going to be an events production company that just produced weird events. And we did, annual events at South by Southwest, and that turned out to be a mistake, because if you're doing it during South by Southwest, there's too many other distractions. You know what I mean? So people would show up, and they might come through for a few minutes, but they didn't really stay very long, and they didn't. A lot of people didn't want to pay to get into an extra, like pay more money to get into an extra event and that sort of thing. But we were coming from a similar kind of mindset. I mean, we saw ourselves as kind of as a coalition of artists and creatives that were kind of building a big installation where a bunch of different things were happening. And it was kind of a blast, but it was really hard to sustain.
And
It
I
was, and
also
I really.
really
It was really expensive too. That's the problem with having a really successful event like South by Southwest is, as the years went on, things that you used to be able to rent for $1,000 or $5,000 were suddenly $20,000, and that kind of prices, independents out of the game, and it's only the big guys that are able to afford all the event spaces that exist in Austin.
And Meow Wolfs are incredibly expensive to build. I mean, there's so much that that I've even learned, seeing the process of, it's just it's construction, and production. And it's just like there is, like what I was mentioning before, there is, you see maybe 10% of the work on the outside at a Meow Wolf. And you go behind the scenes and look at the server rooms and the documents and the schematics and the one line diagrams, and it's like, oh my God, there is just like, before anything even begins production, we've done interactivity matrices, we've built out diagrams, and it's kind of amazing to see how much work goes into these. And then just sustaining them too is incredibly expensive, because it's like, yeah, this is stuff that's gonna break, and it's tech, and it's very expensive to maintain. And to have the staff to do that requires, they have to, we hand things off when we're done, so we have to hire people and train them, that have a certain, technical knowledge to be able to fix things on their own. And we're a company of 1,000 people now, across all of our locations, so it's a beast now. It's truly a beast.
Did you work on the temporary installation at South by Southwest a few years ago?
No, the was that the islands, like all
Yeah,
the
I think it
kind of
was.
like, I was not on that project. That was kind of a in between after Denver and before Grapevine project that we did. So yeah, there's been attempts to do more temporary stuff, but even that's, yeah, like you were mentioning, it's hard to get eyeballs on things when you're trying to do something temporary. It's just kind of like you have to do a lot of marketing around that and hope it, you get enough traction in that short amount of time.
Yeah, and that was free to see. I don't know, maybe they limited it to badge holders, but I just kind of thought of that as maybe having some of the same issues that we had with Plutopia. It's like
Yeah, oh, I'm
you got
sure.
a bunch of people at this big event, and you might have this amazing creative installation, but across the street they're giving away free drinks. So what happens? Everybody
It's like
kind of flocks to the free drinks.
it's like you're competing against everybody else's, attempts to draw eyeballs, and who's got the most money to attract. They've got some band, they've got free booze, they've got, somebody famous to pull in people. But yeah, it's even, I mean, it's hard for even permanent installations, just to kind of get people to come back and to know about it and, spend $50 for a ticket. That's what marketing people do.
You had mentioned that you have kind of a retro and vintage aesthetic. How does that kind of play into the work that you do there?
I feel like that's kind of come about based on I've always built my interactives as being very kind of like friendly and approachable. And I think people have a specific, when they see something vintage and, there's like a familiarity with that kind of aesthetic that people feel kind of like at home, it's approachable, they know what to expect from it. So a lot of times I will, take something that's either upcycle something or, kind of use some kind of vintage piece as kind of a starting point. And I feel like it's just people have a much more or much less hesitancy to just approach something and start to play with it if they have kind of a little bit of familiarity with it. And so I've always tried to, kind of lean into that as a way to get people to not be afraid of tech, because I feel like that's, most people's hesitation is that they're going to break it or they don't know how to use it. So it's just like, oh, I might touch the wrong thing. But, if you do provide that kind of like initial kind of familiarity, it just makes people a lot more likely that they're going to, just play with it. And so some of my work has been actually like finding vintage electronics and, kind of recycling them into an interactive, or, just like in the Eye of the Pyramid, which is one of my pieces that's basically just like you push a button and it's a 1 in 100 chance of winning. You might have seen it, John. It's been around to some South by events over the years. And just like making it approachable and simple and beckoning where people can watch somebody else do it first and kind of like, oh, I can do that. So it's always fascinating for me to just kind of be a fly in the wall and watch people play with the things that I make. Because it's always fascinating to watch people and just kind of see how they like. And I a great example is Eye of the Pyramid, where Scoop, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's basically just like a wall hanging piece, a lot of LEDs. It's got a red button that you push and it's basically a random 1 in 100 generator, and it does this kind of build up animation. And then if you win, it does this big kind of like LED light show kind of thing. So it's like kind of a slot machine, that kind of builds up, and then people just want to keep pushing the button. But there's a guy at an event that I had it at that I was just kind of watching him. He walked up to it. He was like in a muscle shirt, real kind of tough guy mentality, and he kind of like walked up to it, kind of looked a little snarky at it. It was like, it's like, what's this goofy game? And he pushed the button and it did, it's thing. Yeah, Eye of the Pyramid. So basically you push the button at the bottom and it does kind of like builds up to the top pyramid. And if you get the 100 win, it'll do this big light show for like 30 seconds and it kind of does this funny sound and it's very like vintage retro aesthetic.
Yeah, I
And
remember it now.
yeah. And so it was great to watch this guy who had this first just kind of like super just like dismissive attitude. He was just kind of like had his arms crossed. It was like, push the button once. And to see him slowly transform back into this like kid, like into this like joy of play was fascinating. Within like three button pushes, you could tell that he was just like his eyes were lit up and he was like, oh my God, it's like I can't stop pushing this button. And it's just I love that kind of those moments when I can see people just kind of like get into that playfulness again.
Pushing the big red button is like at the center of many sci-fi movies, novels, whatever. It's just
Yeah,
like
yeah,
the whole
yeah.
like, don't push the button. No, push the
Yeah,
button.
it's a dopamine thing. I mean, it's like a such a deep like rooted human, kind of like feedback mechanism where it's like you get that reward, but it's like it's like mice trying to like get the, like push the button to get more food. Yeah, so I really enjoy, making things like that people will approach and kind of like, with a little bit of like caution, hesitancy, and then make it kind of reveal itself as you play with it, and you know, kind of like unlock it. And as you play with it more, you get more of that feedback loop happening.
Yeah, you should interface it with a vending machine so that the animal could actually get some peanuts or get some food.
Yeah, I need to learn how to put a coin slot on my thing so I can like make some money off of this. That's what I gotta do. It's like, I'm sure that Eye the Pyramid. So, you know, you basically have, you know, if you push it, you've got, you know, maybe 10 seconds to push it again. And I was at a maker fair. I had it set up at a maker fair here in Austin years ago. And there was a kid who got it twice in a row, which is a 1 in 10,000 chance of happening. And that button had been pushed at least 10,000 times over that weekend. So it was just a matter of time that that was going to happen. But he had no idea how amazing that was. You know, he didn't understand the law of chances and randomness, but you know, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You got it twice in a row. And that's, you know, that's a big deal.
That's pretty fantastic. I have another thing of yours that I was going to ask about from Houston. That's this guy, DJ Megahertz.
Oh yeah, DJ Megahertz. That's my big piece in Houston.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell us about how you put that together?
Yeah, so this, I was approached, so this is in the radio station, and they had a rack room. You know, they wanted a you know, kind of server room with a bunch of, you know, the machines that would be running the radio station and the transmitters and the broadcasters. And so basically I was, you know, tasked with coming up with something that could, you know, be in a rack room. And this was actually inspired by my piece in Maniac, which was a Netflix show that I produced kind of a similar wall of LEDs for. And so this was kind of a completely custom designed interactive. I was basically, it's kind of crazy. It's got 800 buttons on it. There's, let's see, 24 sliders. There's two monitors, 1,000, no, what is it? No, it's more, it's like 1,200 LED, RGB LEDs. So I basically set it up as a big pixel canvas. So if you look at it, it's kind of a perfect grid of these buttons, and you can push all the buttons. And that picture that you showed was actually it as the cat. So that's the hidden kind of narrative element that I mentioned earlier. So I was just going to make this kind of fun interactive game. And then the narrative team was like, hey, what if it's like you unlock, you know, there was a cat in the rat. I don't want to give away too much, but you know, it's like, there's basically a cat that, that this server becomes when you find the hidden kind of way to reveal it. And so you can push buttons, and it's kind of like, you know, has this great sound, kind of like effects that my friend Eric Heap did the sound effects for. So this was actually, we started with five.
I can see the cat.
Yeah, you can see the
face. I can
face.
See the cat,
so
on there.
The two monitors become the eyeballs. And yeah, I drew like a cat face and the nose right there in the middle with the upside down triangle is its nose. So basically, I started out with five blank server racks. That was kind of like, you know, my canvas was just kind of like, okay, it's got to be a server rack. So that's kind of what I'm starting with. And so I got to design that entire wall of, you know, different, I wanted to make it look like an actual, you know, rack room. So came up with a few different, you know, kind of like panel mounted pieces that looked like they would be in a, you know, in a radio station. They've got like brand names. So I designed those panels as, in Illustrator, and then we've got a laser cutter in Santa Fe. So fabricated all these, you know, metal face plates. And then I sourced all the components of like the buttons and the sliders and different LEDs. And basically in that other shot that you showed on the backside, Those are that's a preview of all the PCBs that I designed. So basically, we design our own PCBs. We've got a pick and place machine. We've got a tech fab team in Santa Fe that can solder and basically assemble all of our pieces. We've got all the wires are custom crimped and made and cable managed. So like all of those kind of like you can kind of see a grid of on the back. So all of the I made it very modular. So each of those buttons are like 4x4 button kind of modules. And so design the PCBs and then basically built the entire network of signal flows, so all the button signals go back to a main PCB that is being controlled by a Teensy. And so basically each rack is its own kind of like standalone interactive. And the signals from all the buttons and all the sliders go back to that Teensy, which is a microcontroller similar to an Arduino. And so each rack has kind of a brain that is basically handling all of the input from that rack. And then in our server room, where we've got all of our main machines that run all the lighting networks, all the sound networks, a lot of interactives and video on-demand systems live in an actual server room. And so I have a PC back in the server room that signal is being broadcasted to, like every button push is going over the network to that Windows PC that's running a custom node program. And that custom node program is, basically listening for button pushes and sliders and is basically the state machine. And it's a game platform, basically, that I wrote. And then that outputs LED lighting data over the lighting network. And so all of those lights on the rack are actually just like fixtures, LED fixtures that can be controlled over the network. So I'm basically sending SACN data, which is a streaming lighting protocol, back to the rack to turn on and off all the different button LEDs and blink lights. And all the buttons are RGB, so I can basically use it as a canvas, so you can sit there and, it's kind of a light bright, basically, if you want it to be, you can basically turn on, the dials on it, can adjust the color, and you can basically draw on it like a light bright, because it's a 60 by 48 pixel screen. So super like right up my alley of like low res, pixel art, kind of canvas.
Yeah,
But
I'm
basically,
impressed by the reality of your rack there, because that looks very much like the real thing. Both old school radio, which is kind of how I'm set up here. I've got all rack mount stuff here, and you also look more like the modern radio, which is a lot of electronics, a lot of automation,
right,
because.
and like blinky lights and
Yeah,
yeah, just kind of like
sadly, a lot of radio stations really don't have people running the show. It's just somebody pre-programmed
right, yeah, hitting
the
play or not even having to hit play, basically, yeah.
Now, not an ideal setup, but it's being done successfully some places.
Right, yeah, this was my most like my biggest endeavor at Meow Wolf to date. It started basically actually about a year ago exactly. I came back from my sabbatical and started cranking on it and had about 6 months to make this. And so yeah, I had to design all the files and then they got sent to our paint department who painted them, and then I came up with the designs. I came up with all the brand names for the panels, so they all have kind of like trade not trademark, but they look like brand names. So we kind of wanted to make it look like a mix and match of different like hardware providers. And people ask that, it's like, where did you get these panels? They look like they're real. And it's like, no, we made all of this. Took the painted panels and like laser etched all the decals on them and then clear coated them, and then they're all like, we at Meow Wolf, we are basically building legitimate products. They might be props, they might be dummy, but we have to build things as if they are products. All of our stuff is UL listed. We have to follow code in terms of like wiring and voltages and, amperages and making sure that things can handle current and the power supplies. You open up the bottom. Basically, the interactive is like the top two-thirds of each rack. And at the bottom, there's an access door, just a regular, like 3 foot, door. But you open that up and you see the guts of this machine. It's like all the power supplies. You see the PCBs that I made, all the networking goes through there. So it's actually stuff that our ops team has to work on as if it's like a real piece of machine, that they're having to replace buttons and, troubleshoot, like, oh, this slider doesn't work. It's like, okay, let's take it out. Let's get the multimeter, let's test some connectivity. And, like, oh, this, we need to replace this slider. So we're building things as if they're like actual, like real world, pieces of equipment. So it's super fun.
That's fantastic. Is there something happening in LA?
Yeah. So
coming up.
Yeah, we revealed LA maybe a month, or I guess it's been a couple months now. So we're in full swing production on LA right now. We open, I think it's like fall of next year of 2026. But yeah, we spend a good year and a half in production on these. And then, we will all go out to site. We kind of go out in kind of waves. As part of the tech team, I'm usually one of the last groups of people to go once all the sculptures are, in place and installed. And we've got an art team task force that goes out and does like muraling and kind of like the frosting and kind of like, makes everything kind of complete. And then the tech team comes in and we're the ones that, have the least amount of time at the very end when it's like the opening data set and we're scrambling to just get things on the network. And, it's like a lot of times that's, I really like that phase because it's very much like being in a movie production where it's like, you've got the deadline, you've got things that aren't working, you're trying to, everybody's there, it's all hands on deck. We're all the problem solving really happens because, we build stuff in Santa Fe. We can't test things as they're, everything's on the network, everything talks to each other. So this is the first time a lot of systems have had a chance to like talk to each other and like actually like see if they respond to the lighting network, to see if they get sound. So it's always kind of like a little bit of a nail biting situation where it's like, oh my God, it's like, this is where, we haven't had the opportunity to test all this stuff. And it's always the where all the curveballs are thrown and we're trying to just like work against the clock and, until all hours of the morning.
Yeah, I was impressed by what you said about being, safe and compliant with, the requirements of a event such as yours. When I was working in some events in the Bay Area, I'd go out and I had friends who also did the work and they'd invite me to see their job. And I'd walk back behind where, the event was taking place and look at all the backstage and it's like, this is a death trap. I've got to get out. I go, dude, you are going to go to jail. He's like,
right. Oh, yeah.
Nobody cares.
And, well, yeah, it's funny because
invariably the fire marshal shows up and says, you're done.
Yeah. Right. And I feel like Santa Fe, the first MeowWolf exhibition got away with a lot. One, it's in Santa Fe, which is, somewhat lax compared to Denver and Vegas and, the other locations. So yeah, there's definitely times when people have now looked back at, the Santa Fe exhibition and it's just like, there's hot glue, there's Arduinos hanging on wires, inside of like little cavities. And, now we're having to, build tech enclosures that are, UL listed and, make our own PCBs that, have like reverse polarity protection and, current protection. So yeah, it's kind of funny to see the evolution of a MeowWolf, kind of electronic piece.
Well, now that you're worth something, I mean, you actually have assets, you can't afford those kind of lawsuits that invariably crop up when someone drops a speaker cabinet on top of a patron.
Yeah. And we've got, technical directors now that deal with, hang, we got all this stuff that hangs. So they're the ones that are, they're rigging specialists and, have to like over-engineer everything and have like double, protection for things that are might fall. And, we've got so many things that we consider now, like ADA, like disability compliance, is a big thing, which I appreciate that we're always kind of considering, like, let's make sure it's accessible for everybody and, not make it a, exclusive, kind of like interactive. Let's make sure that anybody in a wheelchair can have the same experience. Which is, yeah, we look at Santa Fe, it's like, oh my God, that place is like, you have to crawl on your, arms and legs to get through some places, so I appreciate that we're kind of like thinking about everybody and, making it a fun place for anybody to experience.
Yeah, it's always kind of fascinating to watch the people going through, fantastic people watching at Meow Wolf for sure.
So
we've reached the end of our hour.
Oh
I
man.
can't believe it, but
Yeah.
we're kind of out of time, but we hope you'll come back and talk to us again
I'd
sometime.
love
This
to,
has been a
yeah.
blast.
It's always been super fun.
Okay, well,
Yeah. Scoop, you got to go to Houston, Meow Wolf, and we can have a report back on your experience.
I'll count on it.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, thanks so much, Alan, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
Yeah, appreciate it. Y'all have a good afternoon.
Thanks, Alan.
All
Okay,
right. we'll see you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.